Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
This is Haggerty Radio Le Mans, the countdown to Le Mans.
Hello, everybody, and welcome along to a special programme as we preview the 2022 Le Mans 24 hours for Haggerty Radio Le Mans on 91.2 FM. I'm John Hindhoff, and joining me in our Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre is Nick Damon and the voice of the WEC as far as the RSL network, which means the whole world, is concerned, is Johnny Palmer. A little bit different in our rundowns this year. We're going to group the two pro classes together, and we'll start with LMGTE Pro, which has just seven entries, but seven entries of which five are the full season WEC, because that's all you've been dealing with this year, JP. Three manufacturers, but three different manufacturers to that which we will talk about in the GTE AM, in that we have Ferrari and Porsche, they're the same, but Chevrolet Corvette for the first time, a full season entrant in the WEC. So let's start there with the Tommy Milner, Nick Tandy and Alexander Sims full season entry. How's the early going been going for the American, now mid-engined V8?
Yeah, I would say middle order of the three, basically. Porsche have looked the strongest, certainly at Sebring. Corvette, with an awful lot of Sebring knowledge, did okay, but it was, I don't really want to mention that dreaded phrase, balance of performance, this early on in the pro, in the pro podcast, but unfortunately we've got to, because, you know, the ACO only have so much data to go on in terms of balancing that Corvette and measuring its pace with the two Ferraris and with the two Porsches. And I do think it struggled on the concrete in Florida. And at Spa, a track that they'd actually had previous World Endurance Championship running in the past, even though they haven't actually, they weren't a full season entry at that time. And again, you know, 2 hours in, you thought, the podium's a strong chance here, but then the car faded for whatever reason. So I still think they're getting to grips with how to set that car up perfectly, and they need a bit of a break from the organisers too. Le Mans a completely different beast, and always has been. You know,
the three substantive drivers, as I mentioned there, Tommy Milner, Nick Tandy and Alexander Sims, added to with the second car for Le Mans, and of course they got the entry. So the 63 is Antonio Garcia, the Spaniard, Jordan Taylor from the US, and Nicky Katzberg from the Netherlands. Now, they have been driving together in the US, but of course the car over there is in a completely different specification. It is backwards engineered to much more of a GT3. They have traction control, they have different power outputs, etc., etc. However, all those drivers, all of those six drivers at Le Mans, if you say it's a different, you know, it's a whole different ball game. This is why they come. This is why they come to Europe to compete at Le Mans. And just because Doug Feehan's not there anymore, nothing in terms of the mentality of that team has changed. This is their big one.
Agreed. And Nicky Katzberg, if anything, is the junior driver of those three. You think about the number of Le Mans combined that Jordan Taylor and Antonio Garcia must have done. Actually, Katzberg's first year was 2018, but he's had plenty of time in that now mid-engined Corvette with it having a major recalibration a couple of years ago. The team are really on top. They'll bring so many fans from the States and just European fans of Corvette too. But it is a question of how quickly they can set the car up on test day. Let's hope that the full complement of guys can be there. Is that an IMSA clash? So,
except there's no GT Pros there. Right. So Detroit has always been on the Saturday of the Sunday test, but those drivers won't be required.
So we'll have both Corvettes for test day, and therefore essential mileage being done throughout Sunday the 5th of June. And they'll then enter race week, hopefully with all the preparation that they need. But I think they will require all of that track time to make sure that they got both cars in the sweet spot.
Let's go to Ferrari next and to Riley Motorsports. Let's do EF Corsa with Nick. 51 and 52, Marco Ferrari's team. These are full platinum entries. There is only one car in this, which is the third Ferrari, which we'll talk about in a moment, that isn't all crewed by platinum, i.e. factory drivers. 51 and 52, Nick. Alessandro Pergidi, who won the runoff a couple of years ago when Porsche nicked a couple of Ferrari drivers. He's with James Calado and Daniel Serra. See above comment. Very, very good driver lineup. And the second WEC entry is for Miguel Molina, Antonio Fueco, and Davide Rigon. I mean, yes. Not much to say there, really, is there, other than crack on, lads.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, it took Johnny seven words to mention the dreaded balance of performance. But you look at it, you've got seven cars, you've got 21 drivers. As you allude to, anyone's not platinum, that's Shane Van Gisbergen, so he's obviously rubbish.
Felipe Fraga, talk about in a minute as well.
There's nothing to choose between the drivers. There's nothing to choose between the teams. They're all fantastic teams. They've all got experience at Le Mans, or they have borrowed some experience from Le Mans. It is going to come down to who wins the BOP battle. And then it's down to the normal vagaries of 24. But for the last couple of years, all we've heard is, well, we didn't have a chance from the start. We had the wrong BOP. And I realise these are professional drivers whinging and making excuses. But it does kind of, you do think in this is the one class where they need to get a handle on this. As Johnny said, they haven't got a lot of experience with information about the Corvettes. That's the one that's probably going up one way too far or the other. They've had the same Porsche for 3 years. They've had the same Ferrari for 4 years. The fact they can't balance the damn thing seems ridiculous.
However, there is a change. Because for all of the cars in the FIA WEC and at Le Mans, they're all running on a new fuel this year. And this is the card that Ferrari have been playing since the prologue at Sebring, through Sebring and through Spa. The pro cars in particular apparently don't like this new eco fuel that Total Energy has come about. They don't make the power. They certainly don't make the power where they want to make the power. Why it's particularly the pro cars and not the AM cars has not been adequately explained to me. But if this is a ploy, Ferrari started it early, but they just have not had straight line speed and pace. Doesn't mean they haven't had the results, Johnny, because they have had some decent results, but this is what the talking point from the Ferrari Pro teams has been since the prologue in Sebring back in March.
Yeah, I mean, there are some slight differences between the Pro car performance versus the AM. I think there's different size restrictors in play, and turbos are turned down on the Ferraris in AM. You're able to use, you can only use a little bit less fuel when you fill the cars up after an hour or however long it is. But then they had a cracking Spa. They looked way out of it halfway through, even 4 hours into the sit, and then it just came to Ferrari. Calado, Pergidi, they've just been writing themselves off all the way through the weekend. You know, this is going to be another dreadful one. And then the way that weekend went, I mean, nobody could have pre-planned for a race that had two full red flags in it, safety cars, full course yellows. But
which is what happened at Sebring as well, of course, because we didn't get a full-length race there either.
Yeah, very good point. So We haven't had two standard WEC races yet, and already we're potentially saying the cars in Pro aren't going to be correctly balanced. Nick and I cynical from the years that we've been covering Le Mans? Surely not. I think Ferrari have got more than they have been showing, and that's probably the same for the other teams in Pro, because you don't want to give away too much.
Certainly not the test day, and no. Not even in practice and qualifying at Le Mans.
No, but then we've seen some very late balance of performance changes, you know, Saturday morning. Yeah. They've been adjusting cars. It's an interesting point, but I don't know how this new fuel affects things. It's a great invention by Total Energies, and we'll talk about that in depth across the week, but pretty much renewable fuel this year in the ethanol that comes from the winemaking industry.
Yeah, the bits of the grapes that aren't used for anything else is turned into fuel. Let's talk about that car that isn't all platinum then. Felipe Fraga and Sam Bird, he's the platinum, the Brit. Shane Van Gisbergen, SVG, the Kiwi Uber champion from down under. Supercars, but with GT experience, both in the Liquid Moly Bathurst 12 hours and also over here in Europe as well. I call Shane van Gisbergen the tyre whisperer, Nick, and he does it in the virtual world as well as he does it in the real world. So there's something about Shane's style of driving. He has grip at the end of a run when nobody else has. And as I say, whether that's the virtual world or the real world, he seems to be able to replicate that. Managing tyres at Le Mans is not a skill to be dismissed. I think he'll fit right in. I know he's never been there before, but he's no rabbit, is he?
No, I mean, I think if you go and try and pick a driver from an international series who hasn't done it before and go, I'll have him, you probably have Shane at the top of your list. He's incredibly versatile across virtual, real, scale, the whole lots of motorsport. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, really good to see that. And I think he's going to be absolutely on the pace immediately. And obviously Sam Burwell, Felipe Fraga's no rabbit. So, again, even the team that hasn't packed up with platinum, there's no weak link in any of these teams. This is why, you know, you sit around going, it's either going to be a calamitous muck-up or a random failure, or they'll just start on the back foot because someone's not given them enough boost pressure or too many kilograms of weight, which is, you know, hopefully they get it right. If they get it right, then there'll be seven cars scrapping the whole way through, as has traditionally been the LMGTE Pro way.
Yeah, Felipe Fraga, the Brazilian, as Nick says, he's not going to slow them down. He's a very experienced gold driver, and he knows his way around this place.
Yeah, first Le Mans was actually only 2019, when he will have been racing with Ben Keating in the Project One car. That might have been a championship winning season as well. Felipe, they've had to deal with him being silver and being so good, he's been moved to gold now. Therefore, some more doors have opened, potentially in the pro field, because this is, I mean, effectively a customer car running in pro. You know, they're not factory machines, and we've got fewer and fewer of those. We're down to one this year, which is a shame, but at least Riley Motorsports have managed to find that spot. And Fraga's ability to drive lots of different things, including in his homeland of Brazil, in the Stock Car Championship, he's multi-champion in that as well.
And that is a hugely competitive and lucrative formula out there.
Yeah, some tough tracks to go to and big fields where you've got drivers of equal talent. The cars are identical as well. So you've got to be good to perform well consistently in that. He'll go well again this year.
Two factory Porsches, as you have been watching all year in the WEC, 91 and 92. Six drivers that, quite frankly, you know, pick. You can't pick. There's no weak link. You wouldn't say that any of them are any better or worse than the other. That is a very, very Porsche lineup, Johnny.
Well, Christensen and Kevin Estre, Michael Christensen and Kevin Estre back together again. They spent a season apart and Christensen was brought in as the third driver. But clearly, you know, that is a winning duo. And in the 92, they're back together. Laurence Vanthoor coming in as the third driver. I still can't believe Vanthoor just, you know, it comes in as the, when they need an extra driver. Goodness knows who they're turning down, or rather, who else has been auditioned for that part, should I say. So many drivers, and Vanthoor stands a chance, potentially, if Christensen does step away again, of becoming Kevin Estre's regular teammate. But Vanthoor's so busy elsewhere within GT3, I suppose. It's about finding the vacancies in his season too. Fred Makovicki, he's raced Ferraris, he's raced Aston Martins, but he's become a regular part of Porsche's within the last sort of 4 or 5 years. Joining Richard Leitz, who I think was a race winner in 2012, the first year of the World Endurance Championship, and Jean-Maria Bruni, who is entering something like year six within Porsche. So,
and I still can't get used to him wearing white overalls and not red.
No, phenomenal. This is a very special year for Porsche too, because they'll be concentrating on other things into next year. And they have stated that they'll be doing something special to give these GT cars a send-off at their last Le Mans. So I'm looking forward to whatever that might be.
All right, Nick, is it Corvette, is it Ferrari, or is it Porsche?
Ask the ACO.
All right. If this is to be the swan song this year or next year of LMGTE Pro, that is all right. It's a small field, but it's a very strong field, and we've seen in the in the past that it really does only take two cars or two manufacturers to make a race in this. Johnny, what do you reckon? Ferrari get themselves together and give Corvette a run. Corvette, you know, this is the new car that they wanted to win at Le Mans with. They're desperate to win at Le Mans with the mid-engined car there. 50% win rate has just slightly been dented over the last few years. Or do Porsche send the RSR out in style?
It's very tough. I think Corvette will get it right at some stage, and with the amount of backing from the States, the ACO will want Corvette to be able to punch at least at the weight of everybody else, so they'll ensure that it can be there. But it's an interesting point that Nick makes about, you know, the least amount of data on that car, so it could potentially go dramatically one way or the other. But I do think it's going to be Porsche and their year, because it will just, you know, the headlines will write themselves in that they're stepping away from that class. It's been all about the 92 in recent years, so I'm going to give the 91 car some love and say that Bruni, Leitz and McAveeky, their combination, will win it.
Stay with us, because Johnny and Nick are going to remain with me in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre as we look at the top pro class. That's right at the front of the field. The LMH, the Le Mans Hypercars, is next on our 2022 Le Mans 24-hour preview. So the other all-pro category at the 2022 Le Mans 24 Hours, which is the 99th year that the race has been in operation, is, of course, what the ACO call Hypercar. Now, at the moment, that still has a grandfathered LMP1 car in it, but this is the last year for that. It has two hypercars that are non-hybrid and two hypercars that are. So we have three different vehicles in a, and three different rule sets in a class that only has five cars. Delighted to say that, padding out my comments on them, which would be very short indeed, I still have Nick Damon and Johnny Palmer with me. JP, first of all, we saw history at the first round of the FIA WEC. Four of the five cars are full-season WEC entries, and history was made as the first French car and the first French team took a WEC victory in the hands of Alpine at Sebring at the first round of the season, somewhat spoiling the Peugeot press release I'm sure they were hoping for later in the year. They ran flat out. They had to. That was their plan. A fantastic victory for them, and just desserts for all the hard work that they've put in down through the years?
Oh, so almost. Yeah, definitely, because they've been very loyal to ACO Rules Racing throughout, really, the ladder, because they've been European Le Mans Series champions, they've been World Endurance champions in LMP2. Then they moved up to the top class, which was LMP1 at the time. This is now grandfathered LMP1 car into the hypercar era. We had a transitional season in the World Endurance Championship where there was some success handicapping integrated, so that as a team got higher in the championship, theoretically, the more it was pegged back. So we have had pole positions from Alpine. They did set pole, though, at Sebring, and by a decent margin. It was over a second. But then to sustain that through a troubled race, loads of stoppages, really bad weather, you know, a couple of red flags along the way, and they were in the right place at the right time come the finish. And I think will have surprised Toyota, although it was one of those races you needed a lot of luck and it was very difficult to pre-plan for.
The issue with the Alpine, Nick, and it's a point that we have to keep making, because it looks like they aren't getting the fuel mileage. The truth of the matter is, of course, that when that car was designed, the regulations on fuel cell sizes, fuel tank sizes, call it what you will, was distinctly different from what it is now. And apparently, although that is a new chassis for this year, there's not much they can do to expand that to what they would be allowed this year. So they simply can't get the fuel in the car. Therefore, they have to do more fuel stops than the other hypercars, which is why they can't afford to do anything other than drive flat out. And I don't see any room for sandbags in that car either.
No, I mean, it's now a very old design, you say, a new chassis. I mean, you know, what Johnny said about the loyalty that Alpine have shown the ACO. The ACO has shown them some loyalty because they allowed that it's called an Alpine, when, of course, we all know it's an Orica, and which isn't a problem in P1, but was when they're running in P2, and we'll be running P2 again next year. I mean, it's a great result. Great result for them and fully deserved in Sebring. The Toyotas didn't hit the ground running with their newer design with the smaller tyres, and they also had a wayward driver, which cost them one car, and that's what you need to do. You know, we also, you know, we have seen, you know, Inspire and other one of the teams also take a pole. So in the general rounds of the WEC, the Toyotas aren't all conquering, but I think you've identified the point. While despite one lap pace, it's going to be again impossible for Alpine to win this 24 hours unless the 7 and the 8 trip up.
As far as the driver lineup, André Negrão, the Brazilian, along with Frenchman Nico Lapierre, driving as well as he ever has. Nice to see a smile back on Nico's face in the last few seasons as well. And another Frenchman, Mathieu Vaxivière. That's a solid lineup. It's more than a solid lineup, JP.
Certainly, because they come together from different areas of the ACO rules set, if you like. I mean, Mathieu Vaxivière has actually been doing some really good work within GT3, but he seems to be able to apply himself to a top-level prototype with equally as much pace. I remember for a long period he was silver-rated, but then championship started to roll around, and he's now actually only a gold. I mean, it's a rare thing in hypercar to have non-platinums, if you like, but I mean, he's as good as. Nicolas Lapierre, as you say, very much involved with Cool Racing, who we'll mention later on in other shows. But so he has interest in LMP2, but with the absence of that Swiss squad in the top class, as things stand, yes, he's been welcomed into Alpine's fold once again. And is, on balance, probably the fastest of the three. It's nip and tuck here and there. It'll be interesting to see who's put out for Hyperpole on Friday of race week, because all of those cars, automatically, because there's space for six, there are only five. They're all in, and we can say that now. And André Negrão, a big talent from Brazil, again, raced with Alpine in LMP2. So he was the natural guy to kind of go up the extra step with. Big laugh when you grab him out of the car. You know, he's so enthusiastic, but he's also pretty dramatic on the track, not throwing the thing around. You know, nice and neat and tidy, but a solid pair of hands in that WEC full entry.
And if they turn up for Hyperpole on Friday, they'll be sorely disappointed because it's Thursday this year. It is Thursday evening before we do the full nighttime practice. So that's the A480. Alpine Gibson, the number 36 car. In some ways, that car is the outlier because it isn't to the hypercar regulations. I'm going to leave Toyota Gazoo Racing until last because I want to talk about the Glickenhaus. They will have two cars. The 708 is their full season entry for Olivier Platt, Romain Dumas, and Pipo Durrani. So two Frenchmen and a Brazilian. The 709 is the additional car with Ryan Briscoe, the Australian, Richard Westbrook, the Brit, and Franck Mayeur, the Frenchman. All of those guys have driven for Glickenhaus in other projects and in the development of the 007 LMH. They put in a really good performance, JP, at Spa, particularly in qualifying. They have got a car that on its day, and remember that it is not an all-wheel drive car because it's not a hybrid. It runs the French Pipo Moteur engine, the guys who used to make rally engines, actually. And they have got pace. What they have not had at any stage during this project so far is the reliability over the longer races.
And that's always the thing you're chasing when you're building a brand new prototype, effectively, is you can arguably make it pretty slithery and good down the Mulsanne straight on a single lap, but you want that mixture of outright speed and then to be able to sustain it for two chunks of 12 hours. And that's a massive ask at times. But I've no issue at all with how quickly it went at Spa. And I think they'll be encouraged by Spa being... You've got more gradient chains than at Le Mans there, but you've got a long straight, yeah. You've got a big mixture of corners. So Spa, so often, as the previous round to Le Mans, has proven to be a good test bed to get your Le Mans setup right. And Olivier Plaille did a 202.7 round Spa to take pole position. So was clean of, amazingly, an Alpine in second and the two Toyotas only third and fourth. And I'm fascinated to see whether Toyota... I mean, clearly, they'll want to grab the headlines on Thursday for Hyperpole. But there'll be two cars out... Well, actually, three cars with the two Glickenhouses out there to stop them. And it's a real... There's a real chance that we'll get an upset, at least on Thursday at Le Mans.
Whatever anybody thinks about how Glickenhouse go about what they do, there is an element of bravery, Nick, about coming in with a project like this against the might of Toyota and the spend of Toyota, when we know that Jim Glickenhouse and the rest of the team haven't done that. They have built a car to a very different set of budgetary constraints than Toyota have, than Peugeot and Ferrari, and even, you know, Porsche with the LMDH car will and have. They've taken the options to build a fairly traditional car and not gone the hybrid route, and that has hurt them in performance terms, and they've been looking for some breaks in performance from the ACO. They've also introduced, they've asked and have been allowed brake by wire now, which obviously all the hybrids would have. They were still messing about with that and fine tuning it, actually, at Sebring at Spa. Is it an unequal struggle for them? Do they need BOP help of the kind that Jim Glickenhouse is asking?
The whole entry is the stuff of an Ealing comedy, isn't it, really? The plucky underdog tries to enter the mighty, you know, against the mighty factory. And, of course, in the British film of the 1950s, they would have won. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. This is, you know, unless the other three cars break down, and possibly some of the P2s, it's not going to happen. The car... It's a lovely car. It's a great car, but I don't know. It's not been designed properly, in my opinion, for the regulations it's competing in. If you design it, when you have a clean sheet of paper, which Alpine haven't got, you can design it any way you like. If you then design it wrong, why should you be able to get brakes?
When you say that, do you mean that they made choices? Originally, there was talk of them having an Alfa Romeo engine. Then they went for the bespoke racing motor. They decided against hybrids to cut costs, basically, because they didn't want to have to develop a hybrid system. But that has impacted on the potential performance of the cars. And we've got Peugeot, who aren't even in the championship yet, saying all balance of performance has to be done mathematically and not subjectively for when we come in. And LMDH and two-wheel drive cars shouldn't be able to compete with LMH in the hypercar category. I can see both sides of that argument. There was choices to be made by Glickenhouse. Did they just choose wrong?
They chose what was correct for them at the time. As far as the chance of winning the race on merit, they chose wrong because it's a hybrid class. You're in a hypercar environment. The HY gives it away. Hybrid. Mm. I won't justify Peugeot's comments because it sounds like just Peugeot are coming back exactly the same way they left in 2011, arrogant and wrong. But what I would say is that, you know, the problem for the Glickenhouse is that they have no chance if it rains. That was evident in Spa. The car's challenge disappeared immediately once it gets wet, which is a combination of the way the car's set up and not having four-wheel drive. That's how it is. You've designed it that way. You've got two... Jim's got 2 years in the sun, and he's done the ACO a massive favour.
Yeah.
But let's be honest about this. We get round to the 100th running next year with Ferrari, theoretically, definitely Peugeot, definitely Porsche, a couple of others. They will be at best a footnote and probably not entered.
Harsh. You can't argue with the quality of the drivers, though, JP, because that's class all the way through with the three Frenchmen, a Brazilian, an Australian and a Brit walked into a race car shop. And that's not a joke, it's a reality. And the kind of skill and experience that both of those cars have got with those driver lineups would be the envy of any manufacturer around the world.
Yeah, and I think from, again, without wanting to upset Glickenhaus fans too much, actually a lot of those guys are thinking, great to be involved with Glickenhaus, but I need to be in the, on the radar for potential manufacturer drives in the future as well. Some of them already have sealed deals for the future. So, but it's interesting that there has been no change up in the usual entry for the 708, so that remains as Olivier Pla, Romain Dumas, and Philippe and Pipa Derani, who they were the three in that car. I just remember from last year when we had one Glickenhaus at Portimao, we had two of them then appearing at Le Mans, and they actually shuffled the driver lineup between the two. Ryan Briscoe, Richard Westbrook, and Franck Bayer brought in for the 709. Now, Franck has been driving that the Nürburgring car, the 004.
As has Richie, Westy.
Yes, of course. And so has developed that GT3-esque machine. It's great that their loyalty is rewarded with, you know, the chance to race at Le Mans itself. But you could easily put a more well-known car manufacturer in that column next to those names and they wouldn't look out of their depth at all. Correct. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong at all with Jim Glickenhaus's recruitment strategy to find guys who want to race in hypercar.
I think all of those drivers have been works drivers at one stage or another for various manufacturers. Mm. I'll stand to be corrected on that. Focus on pole position for Glickenhaus, Nick, for a bit of glory. They've got a chance.
Yeah, if it's dry and it's pleasant, they've got a very good chance. I mean, I think, you know, the Toyota has not proved to be massively quicker over a lap. We've not seen it in unfettered, let's go for it, Le Mans style yet. But then again, in some ways, oddly, it's a much better story for Toyota if somebody else takes pole and they then win. Because this total domination they've had the last couple of years, like no competition, where we all go, not their fault, but we're all in the back of mind thinking they didn't beat anybody. Mm. You know, if they can prove, oh no,
well, they had to beat their mechanical issues a couple of last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, they've been competing against themselves for 3 years now. This is the fourth year they competed against themselves, and then again, not their fault, but it's a fact.
Well, let's talk about Toyota, and before we talk about the car and their trials and tribulations in the early part of the season with the two WEC races we've seen so far, let's go straight to the drivers because the number 7 car, Mike Conway, Kamui Kobayashi, Jose Maria Lopez. Jose again making mistakes. We thought he'd gone past that. World champion in other formula, of course. Made two mistakes in quick succession at Sebring that took the car out of contention. In the other car, the 8, Seb Buemi and Brendan Hartley with Ryo Hirakawa, the Japanese driver, into that squad. Let's talk about that number 8 car then, JP. A little bit of a change up in what's going on because there's been a change in duties for the driver that Ryo replaces.
Yes, because Kazuki Nakajima, who'd been in the car, one of the Toyotas, I think since the start of Toyota's run in the World Endurance Championship, I'm feeling he was an ever-present. So it was big news that he was to step away and more into an ambassadorial role, I think, within Toyota. You'll know exactly the wording of it. But he stayed...
Team management as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, he almost... He's still not that old and could probably still produce great results on the track, but maybe looking for the next challenge within management and, you know, the next layer up. So good luck to Kaz for that. And I'm sure we'll catch a sight of his face in the garage with Gazoo Racing. But Ryo Hirakawa has been brought in because, again, a massive talent who's still got some of that to untap. Will slot straight in as a platinum from his single-seater experience. He did at least a season in ELMS, might have even won it the first attempt. So there's no question he is uber quick and will join Brendan Hartley, who might be pulled out in the number 8 car for Hyperpole. We'll wait and see. Sebastian Buemi, again, if not a full ever-present, he runs Kaz Nakajima close. I have to check back to when Toyota first entered the World Endurance Championship, but I think Buemi was there in that season. Unfortunately, we all remember Jose Maria Lopez's crash at Sebring. The 8 car had all the bad luck at Spa with the technical gremlins, which actually resulted in that car pulling over and going out of the race, and it
meant, and that was a fundamental issue with the hybrid system that meant Seb Buemi was told clearly by the team, do not ground yourself when you're getting out that car. We can't tell you that the battery pack and the hybrid system is safe. And they had to run somebody out with the little super duper briefcase of redemption in the Clio RS or whatever it was that they ran them around to make the car safe.
Yes, the marshals are clearly given a very special briefing for the World Endurance Championship, and some of the marshals will probably actually follow the championship around the world with it. Do not touch the car. If there's not a displayed light or whatever the signal is, and they were saying just stand away from it, they had to somehow help Buemi out. I mean, obviously, he's been given the instruction as well, but we might have a situation like this at Le Mans too. Mm. That's what I mean, but it's really terrible preparation, if you like, going into Le Mans to have one car that had this issue in only a 6-hour race, and it wasn't probably a third into it when they had to basically say shut the thing off and deconstruct the bomb, if you like. We had to send specialists out with the briefcase, as you say, and make it safe to touch once more. So that's the modern era we live in with the hybrid technology. It's exciting, but highly dangerous if in the wrong hands.
It just doesn't seem to me that the GR010 has really hit the spot for Toyota. Yes, they've had good results with it, but it's still clearly a work in progress, Nick. They changed to a different set of bodywork for this season to work with the smaller tyres, as they've been asked to do by the ACO, to bring them into line with what we presume will be the tyre sizes for the LMDH cars, the DPI 2.0s. Toyota also looking to get a little bit of a change in front to rear weight balance because of the change in the wheel sizes, and also some aero balance back, which they've been trying to fight against. It's caused them some problems because it just does not, as I say, seem to be the finished article yet.
But yeah, but the point about this is not the year they're designing it for, is it? They're designing it for next year when they've got some real competition, so they can make these mistakes, they can have these problems, and they'll still have both championships at the end of the season in WEC. Now, obviously, they can't make the issue. They've only got one chance in Le Mans, and consciously what Johnny says, having that hybrid failure in Spa is great because that means they'll now know why it failed. And it won't fail at Le Mans.
Well, you say that, but they had that issue last year that they thought they'd cleared up when Monza was before Le Mans last year. And they thought they'd cleared it up and they'd actually solved a different problem. And then they had that fuel pump issue that they had to fight against all the way through the race to get it through. I'm absolutely certain they would have been more happy with a clear run to Le Mans.
No, I mean, well, obviously, yes. I mean, it doesn't help when you have one of your drivers having brain fade and wrecking a car, and it doesn't help when that car doesn't restart after a weird combination of red flags and stopping on the grid. I mean, yeah, it's not a perfect combination, but then again, this is a chance for them to do what they've normally done, which is put the car down the ground and run it for the time at Le Mans, which they've been very successful. They've not had since they agonisingly lost the race, with half a lap to go, they've really been pretty much flawless at Le Mans. You know, they've had problems, but the cars are still all across the line. Mm. Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say, I am surprised they've not used this year to do more driver experimentation. Perhaps they will post Le Mans. Mm. I mean, we all know that one of Nick de Vries's three options for next year is a Toyota Works drive. The other option is, he might get into F1, which kind of ebbs and flows every half hour, but every time Nicholas Latifi hits a wall. And there's obviously still the Formula E stuff. So they're obviously thinking of replacing someone. To me, they've got this chance to actually get the best drivers. Now, they've got five good drivers and a World Touring Car champion. But none of these, two or three of these drivers are getting a little bit long in the tooth, and you would say are over the hump and perhaps looking at different elements in their career. If you're going to start thinking about how we're going to attack the new LMDH regulations, you want to have a set of drivers who you think, right, these can run for us for the next 3 years as our team, and we can focus around. They've been given effectively this 3 year ahead of Porsche joining, because that's the real worry, let's be honest about this, ahead of Porsche joining, to divert the car, great, and that's exactly what they're doing, but they should divert the driving stock. I'm really surprised they've just stuck with so many of these guys. I mean, there's nothing against five of them. It's, you know, I'm not quite sure why they've not thought about more rotation, looking around, seeing where they can improve gelling and that sort of thing. I suppose they are absolutely wedded to a Japanese national in each of the cars. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's good that Rio's come in. Kamui obviously also now has a management role. Perhaps this is his last year. If it is his last year, then really he needs to be... They should think about his replacement from Monza onwards.
A succession plan, yeah, absolutely. Kamui was wearing many hats at Sebring when I was talking. Three, I think, because he was driving a Toyota. He was team managing the Toyota, and he was racing in IMSA, WeatherTech as well, where he had to obey his own rule that he couldn't get in the car he was racing in but for IMSA until he'd finished his driving in the 7 car, which was rather sooner than he'd anticipated, of course, but never mind. Can you see anything other than a Toyota victory? There's no foregone conclusions with Le Mans because it's a 24-hour race. Most 24-hour races, there's no foregone conclusions. And what we've seen this year, particularly from Toyota, is a lack, an unusual lack of reliability. They have been making... approaches to the ACO about the balance of performance, particularly about the hybrid deployment speed, which at 190k at most places, not Le Mans in fairness, but at most places has been pretty useless to them. And that isn't just about boosting out of corners, that's about how the car turns in, how it rotates, etc., etc. It's the big one for them, and they're still in with championship contention, of course they are. But surely they're not going to trip over here.
Part of it is down to how much pressure they're going to be under during the 24 hours. And you look at the competition in hypercar and argue very relatively little, actually, because Alpine and Glickenhaus will threaten on the first few laps. But then when the Alpine needs to refuel and when the Glickenhaus loses some of that top-end pace or just can't carry it as consistently as the 7 and the 8 Toyotas, then the threat's not necessarily going to come from hypercar. If we get some weather, it's rare that we get a red flag at Le Mans, but if they haven't quite got to the bottom of this hybrid issue, or in fixing it, as I think you were suggesting, they've actually created another problem that they haven't discovered yet, then I think that may potentially bring LMP2 into the game. But I can't see there's much threat from elsewhere in hypercar, and we would have to have a lot of wet weather so that to kind of peg the Toyota back. Because if you remember, about halfway through or maybe beyond that in Spa, we actually had an LMP2 car leading in a safety car because there just hadn't been the opportunity for the Toyota to stretch its legs comparatively. I think there'll be more than enough laps to extend that gap between the top class and the B class of prototypes, if you like. And I just can't see that the other competition in hypercar is going to be strong enough this year.
LMP2's slowed down again this year as well. So that will be an even bigger ask than it would have normally been. So 7 or 8 then, I suppose that's what I've got to ask for the overall victory.
Well, obviously 8.
Obviously, okay, he says.
Because seven's going to be crashed, is it again?
Well, in fairness to the Argentinian, he does seem to be... there's enough straights to make less mistakes at Le Mans, so...
Yeah, well.
He makes less mistakes.
Okay. less important mistakes, maybe. Johnny, Toyota to win. Both cars at the finish. Glickenhaus on the podium. What do you see in terms of a headline that somebody's going to be happy about? Can Alpine push them all? Alpine's only got one car. That's the thing that I always think. So they have got no choice. They just have to drive absolutely flat out all the time and get right to the end of that fuel, which is harder at Le Mans because of the lap length. So what do you reckon?
I think Alpine will make the finish, and I think they should do that with not too much trouble along the way, but they're going to be pitting far more often than the other cars in the class, so that will take them out of it and possibly into the field of LMP2s come the result. Glickenhaus for the top five, maybe. I think top three might be a bit of a stretch.
You're talking about overall with the P2s. Oh, yeah. If you're talking about prototypes, yeah.
Correct, yeah. So Yeah, I mean, you could read that as all five hypercars have a trouble-free run and therefore they're in the top five, but I don't think they will. I think one of the Glickenhaus will hit problems. I'm not going to tell you which one because I don't know, obviously, but and the other one will do a sufficient amount of distance, but it won't be enough to get ahead of the LMP2 winner. Toyota need a clean run from both cars, though, to finish on the top two positions. So, but I think they will. I think they'll do it, and I think it'll be the eight car that beats the seven.
Okay, so two votes for the eight there. It all starts the Sunday before the race with the full day of the Le Mans test. And the only place that you can pick up any live broadcast coverage of that is via Haggerty Radio Le Mans, 91.2 FM around the circuit and on RS1 via radio-show.co.uk. Thank you to my two guests, Johnny Palmer, our voice of the WEC, and Nick Damon, just our voice. We'll see you at Le Mans for extended coverage of the 2022 Le Mans 24 Hours.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at radiolemans.com.